Hello, it is Friday, the 17th of July. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. And the first Constitutional Day to be celebrated as a national holiday in 18 years, National Assembly Speaker Cho Jung-sik proposed constitutional amendments. More on that shortly. In our in-depth news analysis, we talk with an insect ecologist about why South Korea is seeing more love bugs and whether climate change is rewriting Korea's insect map. In lieu of our Korea Trending segment, we talk with pianist Son Se-hyuk, who won the top prize at the Prague Spring International Music Competition in May. Plus, we invite our regular movie critics to discuss the film Hope, which has sold 1 million tickets as of today in record speed. Korea 24 starts now.
J78주년 제헌절 견축식을 시작하겠습니다.
South Korea held a ceremony on Friday marking the 78th Constitution Day. On this occasion, National Assembly Speaker Cho Jung-sik proposed completing a constitutional amendment before the end of the 22nd National Assembly's term. The main opposition, People Power Party, pushed back, alleging that the ruling party is seeking the amendment for political gain. To give us the latest on this political tug of war, as well as some of our other headlines of the day, we have with us in the studio our KBS World News editor, Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Andrew.
It was the first time in 18 years that the day was celebrated as a public holiday. What can you tell us about the back and forth between the rival parties?
Well, at a ceremony marking the 78th Constitution Day, Assembly Speaker Cho Jung-sik put constitutional reform back on the table after it failed to pass in the first half of the 22nd term of the National Assembly. Cho proposed drafting an amendment bill next year to complete the process before the Assembly's current term ends in May 2028, noting that next year will also mark 40 years since the last constitutional revision in 1987. He stated that the Assembly should begin by addressing issues on which both parties are likely to agree, such as reflecting the spirit of the 1980 Gwangju Democratic Uprising in the Constitution's preamble and limiting the president's martial law powers. Once these matters are settled, they will tackle more challenging issues, such as reforming the National Election Commission.
My understanding is that the People Power Party had initially planned to boycott the ceremony to protest the Democratic Party's unilateral selection of standing committee chairs for the second half of the 22nd National Assembly. Is that correct?
That's right. But in the end, the PPP floor leadership attended the event, emphasizing the importance of prioritizing the bigger picture. Still, PPP floor leader Jeong Jeom-sik slammed the ruling camp for undermining and violating the spirit of the Constitution by neglecting to engage with and compromise with the opposition in handling state affairs. He added that the key values and principles of the Constitution, such as freedom of expression, separation of powers, and independence of the judiciary, are being infringed upon by the ruling party's legislative power.
Let's look at some of our other headlines. U.S. President Donald Trump has once again claimed that China interfered in the 2020 U.S. presidential election and unlawfully obtained data on hundreds of millions of American voters. He added that newly declassified intelligence shows Russia, Iran, and North Korea are also capable of breaching U.S. election systems. Hee-jin, can you elaborate on what Trump said?
Well, in a primetime address to the nation on Thursday, Trump announced the immediate declassification and release of critical intelligence, revealing shocking vulnerabilities in the U.S. election infrastructure. Referring to an inquiry by the White House Government Transparency Task Force, Trump stated that beginning with the 2020 election cycle, China undertook what is believed to be, quote, the largest compromise of election data in history, unquote, resulting in the illegal acquisition of 220 million U.S. voter files. He noted an assessment indicating that adversaries and non-state actors, including Russia, China, Iran and North Korea, are believed to have the capability to compromise U.S. election infrastructure. Let's listen to his remarks.
As one assessment states, we judge that the United States adversaries, including at a minimum Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, as well as non-state groups, have the capability to compromise U.S. election infrastructure. That's unquote, but that's some statement, isn't it?
Prior to Trump's speech, Liu Chang, spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington, told Reuters that Beijing, quote, has never and will never interfere in the presidential elections of the U.S. Several U.S. media outlets, including the New York Times and CNN, reported that voter files allegedly obtained by China were already in public records and that no evidence was found to support claims that the actual election results had been manipulated.
Meanwhile, Washington has announced new visa rules that would limit the length of stay by foreign students and other on work and study-based exchange programs to 4 years. Heejin, I understand this will impact more than 13,000 South Koreans that are living in the U.S.
Yes, that's right. The United States has announced new visa rules that would limit the length of stay by foreign students and others on work and study-based exchange programs to 4 years, a change expected to affect more than 13,000 South Koreans currently in the U.S. who fall under these categories. In a press release on Thursday, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said the new rules are expected to eliminate the loophole that allowed foreign students and exchange visitors to commit what they called visa abuse by remaining in the U.S. indefinitely. F1 students and J1 visa holders, along with their families, will be admitted for the duration of their program, which is no more than 4 years, and those who require more time must apply for a stay extension and undergo a strict vetting process. According to the South Korean embassy in Washington, as of 2025, nearly 12,000 South Koreans were residing in the U.S. on F1 student visas, along with some 1,300 family members accompanying them on F2 visas. There were 349 South Koreans holding foreign media I visas and exchange visitors who entered the U.S. on J1 visas numbered nearly 8,000, with more than 3,000 family members.
And as downpours are forecast for the rest of the weekend, the government raised its landslide crisis alert across the nation, except for the southernmost Jeju Island, by a notch to the second lowest, quote, caution level on the 4-point scale. What's the latest in the advisory and the weather?
Well, the Korea Forest Service said a landslide crisis alert will be raised for the country's 15 major cities and provinces as of 1:30 p.m. Friday. Monsoon rains are forecast nationwide from Friday night through Sunday, with at least 300 millimeters of precipitation expected to hit the capital area and the inland and mountainous regions of eastern Gangwon Province. The agency added that the central Chungcheong region will see at least 250 millimeters of rain. The forestry agency has cautioned residents in the affected regions to avoid outdoor activities near forested areas and to heed emergency disaster warning texts and evacuation instructions in their communities.
And finally, director Na Hong-jin's new film Hope crossed the 1 million admissions mark on Friday, just 3 days after its release, setting a new record for the fastest film this year to reach that milestone. So, Heejin, tell us more.
Well, distributor Plus M Entertainment announced Friday afternoon that Hope had surpassed 1 million ticket sales. According to the Korean Film Council's integrated computer network, the film surpassed the 1 million mark around Friday noon. Hope, which opened on July 15th, follows the chaos that erupts when an unidentified alien creature appears in the fictional coastal village of Hopo, located near the demilitarized zone. The film marks Na's first feature in a decade, following his 2016 film, The Wailing.
And we'll talk more about this film, of course, on Movie Spotlight today, so stay tuned for that. But that's now it for today's news briefing. Heejin, thank you for these updates.
Thank you.
Korea's insect ecosystem is visibly changing. Love bugs, or Aplysia longiforceps, first spotted in Incheon in 2015 and native to warmer parts of southern China, have surged around Seoul since 2022. While love bugs are only a nuisance and are beneficial, complaints to the municipal office jumped from 4,448 in 2022 to 13,127 in 2024, with hikers reporting piles of dead bugs over 10 centimeters deep on trails. It's not an isolated case. Researchers are also tracking longer seasonal activity windows for mosquitoes that can carry Japanese encephalitis. And recent island surveys found that over half of newly recorded insect species in Korea over the past 4 years are tropical or subtropical, species that were not previously witnessed in Korea. So how much is rising temperature actually reshaping insect life in East Asian countries like Korea? To answer that question, we have insect ecologist Dr. Chris Wickhouse from the School of the Environment at the University of Queensland on the line today. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Wickhouse.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. It's a real honor.
The honor is ours. We want to first start by asking you how global warming has affected insect ecosystems globally. What is academia focusing on regarding this topic these days?
Yeah, thank you very much for that question. Maybe before answering that question, I first want to emphasize that. So the love bugs that you're dealing with in Korea, they are not necessarily a nuisance, or they may be a nuisance to runners or hikers, but they are beneficial to us. So they are decomposers, they break down organic matter, they ensure ecosystem functioning. And the outbreaks, they could be indicative of a warming climate, but they can also be signals that something more insidious or serious is amiss with insects in Korea, with nature in general in Korea and beyond Korea. They can be the proverbial canaries in a coal mine, and they could be signals, those outbreaks could be signals that nature is decaying or unraveling. So now, as for your question, may I first indicate that insects are very important for us as human beings. They are the most specious class of animals on Earth. They lay at the basis of many ecosystem services. They provide services that are invaluable to human beings, from nutrient cycling to pollination to natural pest control. And without insects, we honestly wouldn't be here. And if insects would disappear or experience drastic declines, so honestly, so would we. And insects nowadays, they are really under pressure. Their populations are undergoing a precipitous decline, as closely monitored in Europe and in North America, but also as also picked up in Eastern Asia. And four factors are driving that insect decline. It's habitat loss, that's chemical pollution, that's especially the overuse or misuse of pesticides and fertilizers. There's invasive species, and as you very well indicated, there's climate change as the fourth most important driver. And climate change or global warming is affecting insects in myriad ways. So that either directly expanding their distributional range, or indirectly through the loss of host plants or the impacts on the availability or the quality of their food items. And that's what the academia is focusing on right now. So they are trying to understand all those underlying drivers and ways to mitigate those stressors on insect communities.
You mentioned global warming, climate change being one of the main factors. How has global warming influenced the focus of insect research in East Asia in particular?
Oh, in East Asia, the impacts are very much the same as across the globe. And so insect ecologists and entomologists are investigating that very, very, very closely. So And they are describing new species, they're documenting insect biodiversity, they're studying insect-mediated services, they're devising and field testing conservation strategies. So they're looking at different ways to mitigate those climate change-related stressors.
One of those studies says 55%, 25 out of 45, that is, of newly recorded insects on Korean islands over the past 4 years were tropical or subtropical species. How surprising is this 55% ratio to you?
Oh, that's not surprising at all, to be honest. So there's a couple of years ago, there was a study published, a global study, that projected that over the next decades, two-thirds of tropical insects would move into temperate zones. So insects that now are present in countries like Vietnam or the Philippines or southern China, eventually they will move northward and will start to appear in countries such as yours. So new species will appear, as you're already documenting in the islands of Korea, with 55% of species that are being found emanating from the tropics or the subtropics. But species that have historically been adapted to Korean climates, they will also move north, yeah, because the climate in Korea is warming up. So they will move more north to more suitable climates, or in mountainous settings, they will move up, to higher altitudes where the climates tend to be cooler, or they will disappear altogether, which would be very, very worrying indeed.
One of those insects that have been migrating and thankfully not disappearing is a rare insect, at least previously rare here in Korea, love bugs. They've been seen in higher numbers in Korea due to the rising temperatures. Have there been large sightings of similar bugs in other East Asian countries?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, insect populations in general, they tend to fluctuate. You know, they fluctuate over time. They fluctuate due to climatic variables, due to weather conditions. But what we do see in Eastern Asia, as across the globe, is that some unusual species of insects start to attain outbreak levels, and especially for agricultural pests. What we see is that the outbreaks tend to increase in magnitude and in frequency, which is of major concern to farmers and to food producers. And those outbreaks, or the outbreak frequency and magnitude, appears to be triggered by climate change. You have some higher temperatures, and they may favor the development of particular species. But it could also be indicative of a broader unraveling or decaying of ecosystem functions and processes. So there are in nature, in the insect ecosystem, there are different forces that ensure balance, that maintain everything harmoniously, functioning well, in equilibrium. And love bugs, such as all the other insects, they have enemies. They have enemies, co-evolved enemies in the ecosystem, predators such as spiders or ground beetles that keep their populations in check. But when those co-evolved predators, those so-called natural enemies, when they start to disappear, for example, due to pesticide abuse, then the populations of their prey, of the love bugs, they grow uncontrolled. Yeah, they become to behave erratically and to attain outbreak levels.
We want to zoom out now a little bit. Moving outside East Asia and around the world, is climate change altering how insects migrate? And if so, how and what regions are showing the most dramatic changes?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, so on migration, so many insects across the globe, not only in Eastern Asia, they use wind patterns, the prevailing wind patterns and wind currents, to migrate from one area to another, and they have done so for millennia. Yeah, even before we were here on Earth, insects were already moving around and using those wind patterns to do so. In East Asia, the migratory insects move northward in the spring from tropical and subtropical areas to colonize temperate zones, and then during the fall they engage in return flights, yeah, to escape food shortages or inclement weather during winter. However, climate change is leading to a change in wind pattern. Yeah, some parts of the world are heating up very quickly, and so wind patterns and climate patterns in general are changing dramatically. And this has major implications or repercussions for insect communities. So those changing wind patterns will transport migratory insects to other parts of the world where they're supposed to go. And that's something we've seen with a major crop pest, the fall armyworm, in 2016, a pest that was historically confined to Latin America, suddenly made its appearance in West Africa. A change in climate-induced changes in wind patterns can also make that both beneficial insects as well as pestivorous insects, they end up in the ocean instead of in the mainland. So major disturbances can be expected, and I personally think that those disturbances will be most pronounced at the interface between tropical and temperate areas, and they will impact pests as well as innocuous species, such as, for example, in North America, the monarch butterflies, which are emblematic migratory insects.
These are some troubling trends that you have mentioned, and I do not enjoy listening to these remarks. But are there new insect species that have emerged due to climate change or insects at risk for extinction? You just mentioned the monarch butterflies in North America. Any particular insects that you are keeping an eye on?
Oh, well, I'm keeping an eye on many insects. As an entomologist, I have to see the whole picture, no? So my main concern goes towards the higher trophic levels. Yeah, the insects that are feeding on other insects. So climate change and global change in particular is affecting all species and all groups of insects to some extent. But those higher trophic levels, they may be more vulnerable or susceptible than the species, for example, that feed on plants or that occur in the soil. And those higher trophic levels, those carnivorous insects, the predatory bugs, the predatory beetles, the parasitic wasps, for example, are exactly the ones that ensure the sound functioning of agriculture as well as natural ecosystems. They are the ones that provide balance. They are the ones that ensure that everything continues to proceed harmoniously. And those are the ones that are exquisitely susceptible to climate change as well as to global change, to man-made the disturbances. And once they are gone, balance will be lost, and insect populations in Korea as well as across the globe will start to behave erratically, just as you are seeing with love bugs in your country. We will start to see more and more often with many other species also in many other countries.
Those were some troubling forecasts that you shared with us. But going forward, do you expect the change of insect ecosystems to accelerate in East Asia and in other parts of Asia and possibly globally? And finally, how might that affect people's lives or agriculture, disease risk or ecosystems? What are some of the larger things that you foresee?
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'm sorry that I'm not a bearer of good messages today. I wish I had some more optimistic and positive news. As for going forward, honestly, unless resolute, decisive action is taken to actively conserve insects in natural and man-made settings and to remediate the foremost stressors to insect populations and to stop or assault on nature, we will probably continue to see those worrying developments as you're seeing right now in Korea. So ways to remediate those stressors are fourfold. We really have to do our best to protect and restore habitats that are vital to insects. We have to make bigger efforts to phase down chemical fertilizer, chemical pesticides, and other pollutants, and to replace them, for example, with biopesticides and biologicals, such as, for example, microbial sprays to control pests, which are already being used by 2/3 of farmers in Brazil, for example. So this is something that is immediately possible, feasible, and economically beneficial for farmers and society as a whole. A third action is to actively prevent invasive species from appearing in your country and in other countries. And a fourth action point is to fight climate change, to stop climate change, to take decisive action to remediate this worrying development. And unless this is done, we as human society or as human beings, we will suffer. Agricultural losses will mount, pollination will become unreliable, pest populations will escalate. So we really need to do our best to actively restore ecosystem functioning, to build resilience, and to work, to learn to work with nature instead of against it. So that's my main message. Let's harness nature to fight climate change, to fight global change, and to conserve insect populations.
Some words of wisdom from Dr. Chris Wickhouse. We should work with nature instead of working against it. Dr. Chris Wickhouse from the School of Environment at the University of Queensland. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much and have a good evening.
A standing ovation and three special awards, Son Se-hyuk, only 18 years old, stole the spotlight with his rendition of Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 1 in D minor in Prague this May. He earned the top prize at the Prague Spring International Music Competition, coming ahead of 41 other pianists. Despite his young age, however, this is not Son's first win. After his debut in 2021 at the Kumho Prodigy Concert, he won first at the Henne Piano Competition. What you are hearing now is Son Se-hyuk playing Ravel, Gaspard de la Nuit, the first movement, Ondine, at the Ljubljana Festival International Competition Piano 2026. Son's career is just beginning and holds enormous potential. He has learned from renowned Italian pianist Fabio Bedini at the prestigious Colburn School. Originally from Suwon, South Korea, Mr. Son is joining us from Los Angeles, where he studies at the Colburn School, to share his thoughts about his musical journey. We are honored to be talking to the young pianist today. Welcome, Mr. Son Se-hyuk.
Oh, hi. Nice to meet you.
great to have you here on the show. The Prague Spring International Music Competition is a huge international tournament for classical music. The last time the organizers held the piano category was in 2021, and a South Korean, Lee Dong-ha, won that year as well. Mr. Son, how did it feel to win this time around, and what does this win mean for you?
Winning this competition wasn't really expected for me. I wasn't really expecting this result. And so when they announced my name, I couldn't really believe, and it felt very unrealistic, but in a very good way. And I would say I was very happy. And also at the same time, I started feeling responsibility of that is, like, winning competition is just the beginning. And also, I felt relieved that the musical path I've been pursuing until now wasn't wrong.
Mm.
And, like, because that is confirmed, I was very happy, I would say.
Did any of your family members or close friends have anything to say about your victory?
My mom was in Prague, and also one of my closest friends flew to Prague when I got into final, and they congratulated me together. And because my friend flew to Prague from Seoul, I think it's more meaningful.
Was your mother emotional, perhaps?
Yeah, she was very emotional. She was sitting in the audience when they were announcing the result. And when they announced my name, I think she cried a little bit.
Mm. And did anything change, other than, of course, your mother being very happy, since your win?
Yeah, a lot of things has changed. I've been receiving many performing opportunities, like way more than I did this competition, obviously. And because of this, I'm feeling more heavy responsibility, because I really want to be beyond the audience's expectation. And I'm also very happy and looking forward to performing many venues.
But tell us more about your performance in Prague this spring. What was going through your mind when you were playing the piano?
I was very nervous before I play, I would say. First, second, final round, all down, I was very nervous. When I started playing, the most important thing I was thinking and I was trying to do is just to make my piece very interesting. And I tried to be more emotional, which is very interesting because many pianists tries to be not too emotional when they play. But I think because I was too nervous, I tried to be emotional to be less nervous and to be more myself.
You talked about your emotions. How does inserting your emotion into your performance, how does that help you? And how did that help you at the competition?
I think I confessed myself more to the audience when I became more emotional. Yeah.
And what was that emotion at the time? Was it sadness? Was it anger? Was it outrage, nervousness? What was it?
It worked more efficiently in the second round. I played Handel's Suite Commission piece and Schumann Opus 26, Carnival in Vienna, and Barber Sonata. And it worked the most in Barber Sonata, that with the piece that represents war. And I just thought about something makes me angry. And I played that piece. I think it worked very well because the war and the anger kind of fits together.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the beginning of your journey. You're originally from Suwon. Can you tell us a little bit about how you started playing the piano?
I started playing piano at the age of 7. And the reason I started playing piano because my mom wanted to. I was born in a Christian family, and one of my mom's wishes was accompanying at the church. That's how I got to start playing the piano. And I really enjoyed it because, of course, you start with easy level, and I thought I was really good at piano. And one time I played, and one time I played in elementary school. I was in second grade at elementary school, and my teacher was pretty impressed, I think, and she suggested me to take this instrument seriously. So I was completely convinced, and I started convincing my mom that I wanted to be a pianist. So I went to the academy, the piano academy, and coincidentally, it was a very famous academy for our middle school audition or our high school audition. And yeah, now I'm here.
Impressed might have been an understatement at the time. Now you're with the Colburn School in Los Angeles, where you are receiving training from a famous Italian pianist by the name of Fabio Bidini. Can you tell us about what it's like to develop your style under him, and who else might be your biggest influences?
So he is he's such an amazing pianist before teacher, and I really love his style, and that's why I applied to Colburn Conservatory of Music. And also as a music educator, he knows many, many things, and I would say he's such a genius. So I have so much things to learn. And also his style of teaching is a little different from other teachers. He draws the big pictures than getting detailed. So he just threw some words after I play the whole piece, and those few words really covers the whole piece. And most of the lessons works like that, and I think it works for me really well because it also helps me to study the piece by myself as well. Not getting too detailed lesson helps me to like guess to study the piece by myself in detail.
Did Mr. Bedini have anything, any advice or tips, or any words of wisdom, in preparing for the competition?
I think it was a week before I left for competition. I asked him how I cannot be nervous before I play because I get like too nervous before I play. And my first thing he said was, he just told me not to be nervous. So I was like, I was like, sir, how? And he told me that he told me to imagine that I have 100% control over the instrument. And also, I have to think. And I have to be, but if I'm not, I have to think that I have 100% control over the piece I'll be playing. And I just have to believe that I'm gonna be perfect on the stage. So, yeah, and I did it, and all around. Didn't work as I thought, didn't work perfectly, but I think it still helped me to make me less nervous.
So, according to Mr. Sunzeok, famous advice from his professor and teacher, Mr. Bedini, is when you're nervous, don't be nervous. The Prague competition has invited you back as a performer next year. Do you have any other competitions or performances that are coming up, especially maybe here in your home country?
Yes, I had upcoming concerts. Only two concerts are confirmed, and I have many other concerts in debating. The most recent one coming is on August 11th. It's Round Debut Music Festival, and it's a chamber concert. I'll be playing Mozart Four Hands Sonata and Saint-Saëns Piano Quartet, and also another recital on September 5th in Busan Nakdo Art Center. I'll be playing pieces by Stravinsky and Beethoven, and I'll be also playing the pieces I played in Prague competition second round.
So, if you want to listen to Mr. Sun play his songs that he played in Prague, Busan is the city to go to. Mr. Sun, what kind of pianist do you hope to become, and where do you hope to go next with your music?
I hope to become a pianist who communicates sincerely with audience through music. And I think, like when I play in a recital, I think the ultimate goal I would have is to give audience lingering feelings. I think what's really important is the after the concert. I really want audience to remember my music for a long time and have. And I want to change their life if it's possible, because some music really changed my life. For example, Mahler 2 really just swapped my life. After hearing Mahler 2 in live, I constantly listen to music every, like 3 hours every day. I want to be the kind of influence to some people if I'm able to.
As a final question, Mr. Sun, do you have any advice to other maybe younger or maybe even older pianists out there who might benefit from your experience and wisdom?
One thing I learned from this Prague competition is that I think it's worth to risk your musical idea, even though it could not be convincing to juries. I think I really recommend you to try your own musical idea in the competition.
And why would you recommend that?
Because some of the juries, they told me that they really like me taking a risk in musical ideas. And it's also my professor's idea, and he gives me many risky ideas. And sometimes I think it works really well in the competition.
That was Mr. Sun Se-hyuk, the winner of the top prize at the Prague Spring International Music Competition. Mr. Sun, thank you again for joining us all the way from Los Angeles, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
It is now time for our Friday segment, Movie Spotlight, where we bicker about the biggest box office hits and indulge in the latest indie picks as well. And joining us in the studio again are our movie critics, Jason Beschervais. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
And Darcy Paquette. Darcy.
Hi, Andrew.
Jason, your pick today is Na Hong Jin's new film, Hope. We were talking about the World Cup just moments ago, but that's a subject for a different day and different time.
It is, yes, yes it is.
But back to the film Hope, which premiered at the Cannes Film Festival to an enthusiastic reaction in May. This is the director's fourth feature film.
That's right. So, you know, this is Na Hong Jin. He's renowned for his kind of relentless pacing that's evident in The Chase of the LSE and The Wailing. He's one of the few filmmakers to have all his films invited to Cannes. And he's also a rare example and illustration of a director who's, you know, really broken out internationally in a big way. He made his, you know, making his debut after 2000. In fact, it was 2008. So he is somewhat unique.
His name is certainly not unfamiliar in this part of the world. Hope, his new film, is also, I believe, not unfamiliar to people here. It's a science fiction action adventure. What can you tell us about the plot?
Yeah, I can't really give too much away, as I always say, but you know what I'll do is I'll see what happens at the beginning, and then, you know, I think that's enough. But yeah, basically at the start of the movie we see that there's this village called Hope. It's located, you know, near the demilitarized zone, and basically this rampage is underway by something, and we're not sure what it is, but something big and scary and, you know, ominous is just, you know, tearing the town into different, you know, into pieces, quite literally. And we follow a few characters, chiefly a local police chief, Pan Jong Min, a local called Sungi, played by Jo In Sung, and there's also a rookie cop, played by Jun Ho Yun. who plays, I mean, she's not at the beginning, she don't really, you don't see her, actually you hear her, and then she plays an increasing role throughout the film. And then after 45 minutes or so, we have a clearer idea, and well, now Hong Jin starts shifting gears.
We were talking about this film, and Darcy mentioned how people were kind of divided. There were the people who were cheering after the screening, and then some people were just silent and wondering why they were there. Jason, what makes this film very special? Is it the acting, the writing? Is it the special effects? What is it?
The special effects, I think, are probably, you know, a film's weak point. I think some people have kind of commented on that. Certainly the critics in Cannes weren't wild about, you know, the visual effects. But I think it's just such a wild ride. I mean, it just takes you in all sorts of different directions. I kind of mentioned earlier about pacing. And I think, yeah, the pacing in the film, he just takes it to a whole different level. It's just kind of really relentless in the way he kind of tackles this this story. I like how you don't see the creature initially, and that really adds tension to the film. It's truly terrifying. And then it's also, I mean, it's just really graphic as well. So the film is it feels like a true kind of genre movie. It's gruesome, it's gory, it's shocking. And also just in terms of the staging of the film as well, it's really it's just well executed. I wouldn't just call it well executed, actually. I would call it, you know, kind of revolutionary, you know, in terms of the way it stages these set pieces. It's truly, you know, quite incredible, actually. Some of the set pieces at the beginning of the film and then later on as well. So, you know, it's just a visual masterpiece. It's unpredictable. We're not quite sure where it's going. I just really, really enjoyed it, like from beginning to end. And it's 2.5 hours, and yet, you know, it kind of races by.
Tell us about the local reaction, though. We're going to hear from Darcy in a little bit, but has it been good? Has it been, you know, bad?
Well, the reaction, you know, I came out thinking that the reaction to the film would actually be quite strong, because it's just so kind of visually just so engrossing. But actually, the reaction online has been somewhat mixed. Actually, you know, some kind of really not so keen on the film for whatever reason. There seems to be a bit of a backlash against it, but there are people, kind of netizens, kind of talking about it and not liking it. Sometimes they've not even seen the film. So, I struggle to kind of understand that, you know, but...
I think the ending too, like, it doesn't give you a really kind of emotional...
There's not a cathartic ending.
But I think it's complicated. You know, at the end, you're kind of pulled in different directions.
Is it like a cliffhanger, or is it...
I wouldn't call it a cliffhanger either, although the story's not quite over. I'd say for sure at the end, but also just, there's a lot of tension, and I mean, part of you expects that there's going to be this huge climax and then everything's going to kind of sort itself out, and then you're going to feel this sense of catharsis at the end, and it denies you that.
Like, is that kind of why some people might not like this, or?
Perhaps. I guess it depends on what you're looking for in the film, because, you know, it'll appeal to some viewers a lot, and other viewers, it just won't be their cup of tea. And so it has to find its audience, I think.
Who are going to be the watchers that are more excited about this film?
I mean, definitely people who are into, as Jason mentioned, like kind of gory thrillers, that kind of thing. And someone looking for something unusual, unique, I guess.
Okay. Well, now to our next film. Darcy, this is a low-budget Korean film that you have picked for this week. This is about two struggling filmmakers. The film is co-directed by its two leading actors. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so it's made by Yam Moon-kyung and Lee Jong-min, who are co-directors and also take the leading roles. These two people, both of them have been acting for a while. This is their first kind of feature debut as directors. Up until this point, it's been in really small roles, some commercial films, some independent films. But I mean, mostly kind of bit parts. And so it is kind of exciting to be introduced to some new faces in this film. And the film, it has had some exposure. So it first screened at the Seoul International Women's Film Festival two summers ago. And since then, it's been to over a dozen film festivals, including the Fantasia Film Festival in Montreal, the Dallas Asian Film Festival, Jakarta Film Week in Indonesia. And so it finally got its local theatrical release on Wednesday.
And what kind of story is this about? You said it's a film about filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, this movie too takes some unexpected turns along the way. Like, I went in without any prior knowledge of the story, and for the first 5 minutes, I thought it was a movie set in space, kind of a feminist science fiction movie. And then I realized that, you know, this is the screenplay that Hannah, one of the main characters, is developing in this filmmaking workshop. And, you know, everybody else in the workshop seems kind of turned off by the man-hating energy of her film. Particularly this guy named Chol, who's writing a noir revenge thriller set in New York. They seem total opposites, but then he approaches her after class and he says that what his film is lacking is some kind of female perspective. And so he asks her to join him and help him out in developing his project. Eventually they realize that they have something in common. Both of them had some experience earlier in their career with this famous older director who, I mean, kind of betrayed them. Both of them feel betrayed. But, you know, there's the story of them in the real world and then the fictional stories that they want to tell. Those start to sort of bleed into the reality in which they're living as well.
So a plot within a plot, and the element about being betrayed about a director almost sounds like it could have happened to them in real life. Is the film saying anything interesting about the Korean film industry? Is it an optimistic or pessimistic portrayal?
I mean, you can't call it optimistic. And certainly I think a lot of people working in the Korean film industry these days are struggling. And, you know, both of them are kind of at that state where, you know, I think when they started, they were young, they had a great deal of idealism, a lot of cinephilia. And, you know, that energy is kind of coming up against, you know, just the struggle of surviving in the film industry. And yet you do feel that both of them still do love films in a really kind of genuine way. And that comes across in the story as well.
Was there like a tinge of cynicism then almost, or?
A bit, yeah. I think that it is a mix because it's cynicism together with, you don't get the sense that they're cynical about film and about the ideal of wanting to make films and to share stories with the audience. But definitely they are a bit cynical about the reality of filmmaking.
Tell us about the two actors and whether or not their acting is worth keeping an eye on.
It is. The actress, I'd seen her face before in one other film that I'd seen a few years ago. And, you know, despite that not being a very big role, I really remembered her face. I think that she has a look that you remember. And the two of them, they have a good kind of camaraderie, I think. You know, maybe that comes from the fact that they're making the film together. And, but yeah, I mean, they don't overact, you know, they don't ever give the sense that they're trying too hard to be likable or anything like that. They're just kind of inhabiting their own, type of characters. And then, you know, as we watch the film, we get quite drawn into their stories.
Jason, I know you haven't watched this film, but
No. As much as I really want to.
From what you've heard from Darcy, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think films that, you know, kind of look at the industry and yeah, they're always move. I mean, Korean directors have always kind of, they always find interesting ways to kind of capture, you know, the environment and that they work in. And yeah, no, it's really, so I'm really intrigued to kind of catch it. I mean, independent films are, you know, a real exciting area of the industry. So, and I was really gutted to be not able to kind of see it. And science fiction is a genre that directors, speaking of which, you know, hope that it's a movie that people, I mean, directors love to watch. Love to work, you know, work in and watch movies, and yeah, it's very hard to make them work for audiences here, as illustrated with Hope. So, yes, very keen to see it all. Yeah, for sure.
That's it for today's movie spotlight. We had in the studio, as usual, Darcy Paquette. Thank you, Darcy.
Thank you.
And Jason Beshervais. Thank you, Jason.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back on Monday. A reminder to our listeners that Korea 24 is produced by an all-star team, starting with our fantastic editor, Daria Kim, our very calm and patient producer, Yun So-hyun, and our very thoughtful leader, producer, Kim Bum-soo. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye.